This is a recording for the Kathy Drury teleconference with American Hospital Association Chicago, Tuesday, September 9th, 2014, scheduled for 11 a.m. Central Time. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your patience in holding. We now have our speakers in conference. Please be aware that each of your lines is in a listen-only mode. At the conclusion of our speakers' presentations, we will open the floor for questions. Instructions will be given at that time on the procedure to follow if you would like to ask a question. It is now my pleasure to turn this conference over to Ashley Hoffman. Ms. Hoffman, you may begin.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the September National Content Webinar. We're so excited to have you with us at today's event, which will focus on complications related to catheter insertion and utilization other than caudies. Quick reminder that before we begin today's presentation, that this is a webinar, so please be sure to log in through the webinar link in order to see the slides today. We'll also post a copy of the slides and the recording on our project website later this week. Now I'd like to introduce our guest speakers for today. Dr. Mohammed Faqih is a professor of medicine at Wayne State University School of Medicine and hospital epidemiologist and medical director of infection prevention and control at St. John Hospital and Medical Center, both in Detroit, Michigan. He is also the National Infectious Diseases Physician Leader for Ascension Health System with more than 100 hospitals. We also have Dr. Nasia Safdar, who is Associate Professor of Infectious Diseases at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. She is also the hospital epidemiologist for the University of Wisconsin Hospital and Clinics. Also joining us today is Dr. Kathleen Fletcher, an Associate Professor of Internal Medicine at the Medical College of Wisconsin and the Milwaukee VA Medical Center. And without further ado, it is my pleasure to introduce our guest speakers. Dr. Faqih?
Thank you very much, Ashley. I'm just going to list to you the learning objectives. Each point is one speaker, so I'll be talking about the urinary catheters as a potential reservoir for transmission of multidrug-resistant organisms. Dr. Safdar will be discussing the impact of unnecessary antimicrobial use in causing C. diff infection. And Dr. Fletcher will be discussing the role of unit culture on prevention of clotting. So we'll start with a polling question. So I'm going to read it. Which of the following is more likely in patients with urinary catheters? The first, you're so fast, guys. The first one would be patients developing symptomatic caudy, and the second one, patients being given inappropriate antimicrobials for asymptomatic bacteriuria. The third would be patient developing bacteremia from a urinary source. So let's vote.
Got about half of the responses in. We'll give everyone about 30 more seconds to select your choice. All right, and I think we've got everyone's responses in.
Okay, so 64% said that the antibiotics patient being given inappropriate antibiotics for asymptomatic bacteriuria, I would vote for the same. So the issue is with inappropriate antimicrobial use, I think, is a major problem. Caudy happens, but not as often as the inappropriate antimicrobial use, or bacteremia is much less likely. So catheter-associated bacteriuria often is misdiagnosed as caudy. So physicians, clinicians give antibiotics inappropriately. Clinicians even give antibiotics even if someone has had a history of Clostridium difficile, and there was a recent study describing that. And bacteremia happens in about 4% or less of cases of bacteriuria, so it's an uncommon event. And when we look at the infectious complications and the relation to the catheter, we focused for the last few years on caudy. And caudy is important, but it's not the only infectious complication. So you can have part of caudy complications would be upper urinary tract involvement, such as bowel nephritis. But let's think about caudy and then developing bacteremia, and that patient has seeding of the bacteremia to areas such as the spine, or developing endocarditis or septic arthritis. You know, these can be disaster complications. Less often talked about, because it's more of an invisible thing, is when you have an asymptomatic urinary colonization, you give antibiotics and you develop either Clostridium difficile infection or MDRO colonization, so you develop multi-drug resistant organisms in the urine. And we never figure out why they happen. It's just we think it's part of being in the hospital. But antimicrobial pressure plays a huge role, or transmission between patients. So when we talk about MDRO colonization, there are two implications. Either that organism would cause infection to the patient who's colonized, or that patient who's colonized will be touched by a healthcare worker, or that patient will contaminate with his or her flora the area close to him or her, and then there's fomite transmission, or a healthcare worker acting as a mode of transmission between patients. So patients with indwelling catheters and colonized urine, there's a much higher risk for them to expose the healthcare worker. Organisms will contaminate also the environment and may survive for months, especially the gram-negatives. And then fomite transmission, whether it's a blood pressure machine, whether it's anything that's shared between patients, if they're not cleaned in between patients, that would happen. Another problem would be the pressure with antibiotics and their side effects, and risk of more resistant organisms and Clostridium difficile. So a simple solution would be minimizing catheter exposure and avoiding unnecessary cultures and promoting appropriate antimicrobial use. When we talk about avoiding unnecessary cultures, we talk about deciding on doing a urine culture when clinically it is a pertinent thing to do. So second polling question, multi-drug resistant organisms. So these are, one of these is correct. So antimicrobial resistance is associated with about $20 billion direct healthcare costs per year. Antimicrobial resistance is associated with $1 billion direct healthcare costs per year. And developing new antibiotics is more important than preventing infection and preventing spread of organisms or MDROs. Sorry, the slide does not show everything well. So my data is from the CDC publication last year that discussed MDROs. All right, well, I think this is good. So the CDC mentions it's $20 billion. So this is from the antibiotic resistance threats in 2013, and they report $20 billion of direct costs to the country. Also what they mention is the four core actions to fight deadly infections, and I put in blue here preventing infections and preventing spread of resistance. And if we think about the urinary catheter, again, this indwelling catheter and having the urine very easily accessible to people to do cultures and then give antibiotics, I think it ties into that first part. Tracking resistant bacteria is another core action plan, improving the use of today's antibiotics and promoting development of new antibiotics and developing new diagnostic tests for resistant bacteria. But you see, item one is what's most pertinent to us. So let's give you a few examples. The example of carbapenem-resistant Enterobacteriaceae, very resistant organisms to many antibiotics. Klebsiella pneumoniae is the main one. It's also called KPCs. And there's the New Delhi metallo beta-lactamase. They are responsible for outbreaks in hospitals. Mortality can be up to 50% with limited antimicrobial availability for these organisms. Again, MMWR 2013 discussed CRE. It's an estimation of the proportion of CREs in the United States. They surveyed acute care hospitals and long-term acute care hospitals, short and long-term, so LTACs and regular acute hospitals. And what they found out within the first 6 months of 2012, at least one case of CRE was present in 4% of short-term acute care hospitals versus LTACs 17.8%. So the LTACs have a higher presence of these organisms versus in CRE in 2001 was much lower. So there is a problem. We're seeing more of CRE in the United States facilities, inpatient facilities. What about the link between CRE and urinary catheters? So when you look at publications, you know, you won't find a publication that says, okay, CRE and the urinary catheter. So you have to dig and see where they're getting these organisms from. And, you know, this is what I tried to do. I tried to share with you different articles and show you how often it's isolated from the urine. So this is the Emerging Infections Program. It's three cities, Atlanta, Minneapolis, and Portland. And they had 72 cases, and most of them came from Atlanta, about 59. And most of the CREs were KPCs, followed by Enterobacter and E. coli. And the urine was the most common source. 89% were urinary organisms. Now, when you look at in the table 3, presence of urinary catheter within the last 2 days, 47% had the urinary catheter. I'm not saying it's a causal relationship, but it's a good association. So CRE and urinary catheters, what are the implications of these findings? Higher mortality than other infections, additional resistance to other antimicrobial classes, and no available novel antimicrobials, and potential rapid spread in healthcare setting, and CRE potential spread in the community also, not just in the hospital. What about LTACs versus ICUs? This is national data published in ICHI in 2012, comparing ICUs to LTACs. The most common organisms in the ICUs were regular hospital ICUs were E. coli and Candida. In the LTACs, it was for copy, it was Klebsiella and Pseudomonas. The LTACs showed more MDROs associated with the copies. And if you see from the figure here, you look at resistant E. fecalis, and the LTACs are black, complete solid black. The LTACs are 40-some percent. Now, VR Ephesium LTACs is almost 95%. And then the Enterobacteriaceae resistant to carbapenems, so almost like CREs, much higher in the LTAC. It's the second circle or oval. So LTACs play a big role in CRE and the resistant MDROs. In the same study, they showed they've seen more VRE isolates reported LTACs. I mentioned that 44% versus ICU 7-13%. The proportion of MDR Pseudomonas copy isolates was 25% in LTACs versus 12-16% in the ICUs, and no significant difference in CRE copy isolates between LTACs and ICUs, but 42% of LTACs reported a CRE copy compared to the ICU's 8-21%. Tevert and Itchy also looked at MDROs and CODI. 2,000 hospitals, CODI organisms showed CRE Klebsiella 12.5%, CRE E. coli 2.3%, and CRE Ephesium was in 86% of the cases, also resistant E. coli and fluoroquinolone-resistant in 67%. So again, the urine is harboring very resistant organisms. The same study, if you look at ICU versus non-ICU, there's some of, you know, a little bit more increased resistance in the ICU versus in the non-ICU versus the ICU. So if you see here in yellow, which kind of interesting. You see 52% for MRSA in the ICU, 63% in non-ICU. The resistant, you know, VRE fecalis, 12% in the non-ICU versus 6% in the ICU, and similar CREs, floor and ICU. You know, there's a typo here, although, you know, we still need to push in the ICUs because of utilization of catheters is high, but the floor is as bad. Michigan experience is another one that I want to share with you. 17 hospitals and 4 LTACs, 6 months data, 102 cases, and, you know, the vast majority of CRE is KPCs. So when they evaluated these cases, 61% were from urine, 15% respiratory, and 10% were blood. But look at this. When they look at the indwelling devices, the urinary catheter is present in half of them. What about nursing homes? It's a prospective evaluation of 15 nursing homes in southeastern Michigan. They compared patients with or without the device, and their definition of device was having a urinary catheter or a feeding tube or both. And 60 of the 90 patients had a urinary catheter, and device group had a higher infection rate and 55% higher urinary tract infection rate. They were also, these patients that have a device were also more likely to be colonized with MDROs. So it may be a marker of degenerative illness and colonization with resistant organisms. So my last slide, you know, what do we learn from the studies? Urinary catheter use is associated with the isolation of MDROs. This is seen in acute care setting, but also in the long-term acute care hospitals and nursing homes in the ICU and non-ICU. And reducing unnecessary urinary catheter use may help reduce MDRO colonization and consequently spread in the healthcare setting. I'm going to give the slides to Dr. Safdar. Thank you.
Thank you, Mohammed. Hi, everyone. This is Nastia Safdar from Wisconsin. So if all of you have read the book, If You Give a Mouse a Cookie, that ends. And so we're going to use that same theme. If you give a patient a urinary catheter, what are the possibilities? And Mohammed outlined that it can lead to a lot of MDRO isolation. My part of the talk will focus on what else can happen, and obviously the big pathogen that we are struggling with right now nationwide is Clostridium difficile infection. So whether somebody has a symptomatic catheter-associated urinary tract infection that requires antibiotics legitimately or asymptomatic bacteria that typically does not need antibiotics, regardless of that, if they're administered, one of the side effects of that can be C. diff infection. Next slide. This is one of many papers that were published when the outbreak of the new virulent strain of C. diff was first identified, and it spread very rapidly and is now a global problem. 6% of our isolates at UW are the NAP1 or the R27 strain, which is the this epidemic strain that produces 16 and 23 times the amount of toxin that your standard C. diff strain will produce, causes patients to have leukemoid reactions, require colectomies, and is often associated with a higher death rate than the non-epidemic strain. Next slide. Now, even though we talk about antimicrobials as all of them being able to induce C. difficile, but clearly there is a difference in the risk and the frequency with which they induce C. diff. And the on the left, the column is the frequent inducers of C. diff, then the one following that is infrequent induction, and the ones that rarely induce it. You will see that even vancomycin is listed there as an antibiotic that may induce C. diff. So any antibiotic, even those that are used for treatment of C. diff, can also cause it, at least in case reports it's been shown. But going back to the first column, so the ones that are used very commonly in hospitals are cephalosporins and fluoroquinolones. And fluoroquinolone use has risen exponentially for obvious reasons. You know, they're oral. While they're not inexpensive, they do offset the cost of having to give somebody an IV anti-infective when they have a reason for an antibiotic. But it is the fluoroquinolones that have led to this upsurge in C. diff, many people think, especially the new epidemic strain, because the distinguishing feature of that strain is that it is resistant to fluoroquinolone. Now, these are also the anti-infectives that are most commonly used for treatment of uropathogens, especially if there is a multi-drug resistant uropathogen. These are often the anti-infectives that are called upon to do their job. Next slide, please. So how does CDIF play into antimicrobial use and hospitalization? The pathogenesis appears to be that an individual gets hospitalized and then gets antimicrobial exposure. And in our scenario, it could be from asymptomatic bacteriuria or it could be from a colony. And then they acquire C. diff from the environment. And because it's a spore-producing organism, it's extraordinarily difficult to completely get rid of C. diff from the environment. Anytime the environment is inhospitable, it simply becomes a spore, and that can last forever. So you then acquire C. diff from the environment, and one of two things will very quickly happen. Either the person will get C. difficile colitis, or they will get asymptomatic C. diff colonization. And neither of these scenarios is particularly attractive, because if they get C. diff colitis, then of course there's all the treatment that needs to happen. But if somebody gets colonized, while they may themselves not get symptomatic, they're certainly more than capable of transmitting it to other individuals in the facility, many of whom are very susceptible to getting C. difficile infection and adverse consequences if they do get it. Next slide. So the overall colectomy rate from C. difficile is about 8 per 1,000 C. difficile cases. And there's a debate about whether that is rising or not. Some facilities have reported an upsurge in it. Other multi-site studies have reported that while the rate is high, it at least doesn't seem to be rising. Nonetheless, this is a significant issue with C. diff because it causes a lot of morbidity and in many cases mortality. Now, unlike colectomy, there's really no debate on the attributable mortality from C. difficile. That is clearly on the rise, and it increased from 3,000 deaths per year during 1999 to 14,000 between 2006 and 2007. And that's a substantial increase, even more so when you consider that over 90% of deaths occur in patients over the age of 65 years, which is what most of the population is expected to be in a few years from now. Next slide, please. There is also a great deal of excess costs that is associated with C. diff, about $4.8 billion in U.S. acute care facilities. The burden and the cost of C. difficile in non-acute care facilities has not been well studied at this point, but is expected to be even higher and to increase as the volume in skilled nursing facilities and long-term acute care hospitals is projected to grow. One of the issues with C. diff that doesn't help is the fact that there is a high recurrence rate, and it ranges from about 20 to 30% for the first recurrence. But if somebody has had a first recurrence, then their likelihood of getting a second recurrence is about 50%, and then it goes higher the more the number of recurrences increase. There is no good treatment for recurrences in the sense that while we often use management that has been generally used for years, it's more anecdote than it is evidence. And the best thing on the horizon is probably fecal microbiota transplantation that does have over a 95% success rate. So what will happen if somebody gets a recurrence of C. diff or if they get severe disease? Well, they get an increased length of stay with C. difficile. They may need ICU care if they're severely ill. And now we're coming back full circle. If they're severely ill, they will likely need a urinary catheter. That was my last slide, I believe, and now I'm going to... Oh, actually, we have a couple more. Sorry, thank you, actually. So what are the things that we can do to reduce C. difficile infection? Well, Mohammed talked about antibiotic use, and I think stewardship, in addition to infection control, is the second prong of our strategy to prevent C. diff. Next slide. But even though it's easy to say, the devil really is in the details. So if you have, this was one study that looked at about 100 consecutive patients with C. diff, and they found that in most of them, at least one preceding course of antibiotics was inappropriate. So by that theory, then, decreasing inappropriate use should lead to reductions in C. diff. But again, defining how to reduce inappropriate use and to sustain that reduction has often proven to be a challenge. Next slide. So this is one study, and there are examples of others, but this was one that looked at impact of antibiotic stewardship specifically on C. diff. And in the first half of the slide on the left, you see that they used an educational intervention. The blue line is MRSA, the purple one is C. diff, and the red one is extended spectrum beta-lactamase producing gram-negative. The solid green is ceftriaxone consumption. So similar to other studies that have looked at educational interventions, you'll see that they didn't really notice a major decline. Ceftriaxone decreased to some extent, but not markedly so, and the lines that highlight the various HAIs didn't change dramatically. Now, you compare that to the next intervention when ceftriaxone was formally restricted from use, meaning that somebody had to actually call the stewardship team and make a case or make an argument for why they needed it. And that degree of restriction dramatically declined the use of ceftriaxone, as you see in the solid green, and also led to reductions in all of the major HAIs. So if we are really to use antibiotic stewardship in our favor, it means that we have to use fairly stringent, drastic tactics to reduce C. diff with this intervention. Next slide. And now I will hand it over to Dr. Fletcher.
Thank you. So we're going to change gears a little bit and talk about some data from a project that I've been working on that's a little bit more qualitative than the data that we've been talking about. I want to just start by saying that some very nice work in terms of trying to understand what the barriers and facilitators are to preventing actually using urinary catheters when they're not supposed to be used, so to preventing inappropriate use. Some very nice work has already been done by Sarah Krine and Molly Harrod out of the University of Michigan, the Ann Arbor VA. And so I went back to some of their work to look to see exactly what they had been hearing about. And we'll talk a little bit about that, and then I'll talk about some of the results that we're seeing in our newer interviews that we've been doing. Next slide, please. So some of the barriers to appropriate use of urinary catheters that have been described before include things that won't surprise you, but lack of physician and nurse engagement was their number one. And when they described those in a little bit more detail, they heard about physician disinterest in getting the catheters out, nurses not really recognizing the potential severity of the problems that resulted from having urinary catheters when they weren't necessary. They referred to loosely coupled errors, and I think about this like that the person who puts in the catheter may or may not actually see the severe cavity that results from it, because it may be days to weeks after that actually occurs. And so the problem with putting in a catheter and what actually happens with that catheter later is not necessarily coupled in the mind of one person. They also noted workload issues leading to workarounds. That's not hard to imagine, especially for nursing, that having patients without catheters may often be more of a workload problem than having patients with catheters. And then a lot of actually weighing the risk of catheters versus other issues. So we know, of course, that having a catheter in could lead to falls, but having a catheter out can also theoretically lead to falls, right, because patients are getting up to the bathroom more and may or may not wait for the nurse to come if they call on the call light. And so there was some evidence in those other studies about the nurses really trying to think about, well, if I take this catheter out, am I really helping the patient? They also noted patient and family requests for catheters and for leaving catheters in for longer than maybe the medical team thought. This was especially true in older patients who were incontinent and the families didn't want to think about them in diapers or sitting in a wet bed, of course. And so that was a barrier that they heard about and noticed. And then another significant barrier that they found was the practice in the EDs. So long before the patients actually even got to the floors or to the ICUs, emergency departments had a policy that they would just put in catheters. And when they explored that, they found that the EDs really thought that they were helping. I mean, in some ways, they were helping themselves by making it more convenient to put the catheter in the patient, because there's not such easy access to bathrooms, for example, in the ED, and they need samples, et cetera. But they also thought that they were helping the floors, the ward nurses, who they perceived really wanted the catheters in when the patients arrived on the floor. Next slide, please. So Molly and Sarah also delineated some facilitators to appropriate urinary catheter use, which are listed on this page. And these were things like engaging the physicians and the nurses. Specifically, they talked about the importance of nurse champions and local, like unit-level nurse champions, to be helpful in this education and engagement endeavor. In terms of patient requests for catheters, they heard about from their interviewees that patient education was necessary, but that could overcome some of the patient barriers. And then they also heard about places that really engaged their ED leadership to try to inform them more about what they really wanted on the wards and what was best for the patients. They talked about education and also monitoring, which we'll come back to again in terms of giving the ED feedback on the number of patients that came up to the wards with catheters in place. Next slide, please. So then I want to tell you a little bit about our study and what we've been hearing about. So one of the goals of this study was to better understand unit-level culture around CAUTI prevention. We have conducted interviews and done observations at four institutions, and we visited and interviewed people from two units at each site. So we've been to eight different units. We included in our interview list nurses from that ward, nurse educators, physicians, and then also hospital leadership as well, so infection preventionists, quality officers, people in charge of safety. And so we have a pretty broad representation from each of these units. We are currently in the process of qualitatively analyzing these transcripts, so I'm going to tell you some interim results that I think are interesting along with some quotes that we've been using, but our final product may end up looking somewhat different than this because we haven't finished analyzing all of the interviews. I'm sorry, somebody's pounding a nail into a wall near me. Hope you can't hear that. Okay, next slide, please. All right. So you'll see that many of our barriers actually mirror the barriers that Krein and Herod described, but we do have a few things that expanded on them, so I want to talk to you a little bit and use their framework. So we did certainly hear about physician barriers. Specifically, we heard about buy-in being fairly sporadic, and so we didn't necessarily hear about disinterest on the part of most physicians, but rather that there was disinterest on the part of some. For example, this unit medical director said, some people see it and some people don't. The people who actually see it, you know, are more prone to doing the thing. The people who don't, you know, just think it's a burden. Next slide. Other physician barriers that we heard about were knowledge of the problem and also maybe lack of knowledge of the financial consequences. So this infection control professional told us, I think certain ones, that is physicians, feel it's very important, and I think other ones will once they realize how it affects the general welfare of patients, plus reporting and plus not getting paid for infections anymore. So I think there's not enough knowledge base on their part of how this is going to affect the bottom line financially as well as, you know, the patient. So here implying that if physicians knew more about the problem and the problems with inappropriate catheter use, as well as the fact that it's really going to start affecting or really is affecting the bottom line, that maybe they would be more interested in helping out with this problem. Next slide, please. Other things that we heard about that I thought were particularly interesting, and these mostly came up in the ICU settings, were the time for checklists. So that's, I guess, not terribly surprising, but physicians saying that they have limited time, a lot of sick patients, and if they're on rounds and they have to choose at the end of rounding on a patient whether they're going to talk about a major problem with the I'm sorry, that is very loud. If they have to choose between going through a checklist and a safety checklist that includes whether or not the catheter can come out versus a one more medical problem of the patient, then they're obviously going to choose the medical problem and possibly divert the discussion of the checklist to one of the more junior members of the team who may or may not take care of it. The other aspect of this that we heard about from the faculty physicians was their level of interest in the checklist versus other things. And here what we heard about was some people speaking very eloquently about, if I am in the room with a patient who has great respiratory physiology on their on their ventilator screen, then I'm going to choose that over reviewing the checklist. And it isn't that I don't think that the CAUTIs are important or that the having the lines out is important, but that isn't where my passion is. And so there were those sorts of physician barriers, realizing that they had a choice to make and choosing the part of the medical care that gave them joy, even though they understood that the rest of it was important too. Next slide. So we also did hear about nurse barriers, and similar to the physician barriers, we heard about enthusiasm that was not a uniform across the nurse population, as one unit medical director told us. So there are mixed feelings. You know, the people or nurses who see the value in it are actually very, very enthusiastic about it. The people who think it's burdensome because it's another thing for them to do are not really enthusiastic. There are mixed feelings about it, actually. Really similar to the quotes that we heard about the physician involvement and interest. Next slide, please. Other nurse barriers that were similar to what Klein and Herod found, workflow issues and the risk of Foley versus other risks. And so I think this quote captures both of them nicely from an RN on one of those wards. She said, I think they always agree with, you know, best practices. I just think sometimes workflow or, you know, if you have a patient who, yes, they can void, but every time the patient uses the urinal, they make a big mess. We're not worried about the patient's skin. That's another issue with incontinence in this environment. You know, the benefits versus the risks of placing the Foley catheter. Yeah, they probably want to go ahead and place that Foley catheter. Maybe we can try that condom catheter or something else first. I think those are, I guess I kind of mentioned that before, but I think those are the day-to-day clinical practice frustrations where it's sometimes hard to do the right thing. Next slide. And then this came up with both nurses and physicians, so I wanted to bring it up. This is especially true in the ICU, that there is a belief in the need of close monitoring of I's and O's. True or not in every case, but we heard about it quite a bit. So, for example, one nurse educator said, most of our patients are critically ill, so we do need the Foley so we can measure output, you know, have very accurate I's and O's for patients. But we do try to remove them as quickly as possible. And another RN who said, in response to a question about what lessons they've learned for implementing catheter-associated urinary tract prevention efforts, I give more attention to the ICUs. I would say that, again, while we're very justified, you know, most of the time in having Foley catheters, we do truly need them. I think sometimes we give ourselves a free pass when maybe we didn't deserve it, and, you know, maybe we should spend a little more time in that practice environment to see if we can decrease the number of actual Foleys that we have and still be able to achieve good, you know, accurate intake and output. It's challenging, but, you know, there may be opportunities there. So you can see, I think, in both of those quotes, both the acknowledgement that they're hiding behind the accurate I's and O's and yet continuing to invoke the accurate I's and O's. Next slide. We actually did not find significant patient and family barriers in the discussions that we had with these units. It occasionally came up, but everybody that we talked to about it felt that they could overcome it pretty easily with some education. Next slide. We did also uncover some interesting administrative barriers. The most significant one, I would say, was an issue around measuring and reporting. And so one infection control professional said this to us when we asked about what lessons she had learned. And she said, "Do you have all day?" Just, it's not as simple as it seems, especially when you have a computerized record and you have so many different factors involved and so many different people involved in making decisions and what is important and not important and how to roll it out. And then also just the documentation of it. You know, you want it measured, but they're not agreeing in how to document it or how to measure it. And what she was talking about here was the great number of different organizations that they actually had to report out data to, and her feeling that it was not the same data that each organization wanted. So they ended up collecting all this data and putting it together in different ways to please UHC or SCIP or the CDC. And so they found that to be frustrating, along with the changing of definitions, et cetera.
all rolled up with all of these other issues, like how do you even roll it out when you have an EHR? Next slide, please. The other administrative barrier that we heard about was just the need for and the difficulty in having dedicated, sustained attention to that issue. And this infection control professional said, so that's the other hardship, and having to dedicate people underneath to be able to follow through on it. It just can't be, the infection team doing it. It has to be on every floor. It has to be an active involvement. So you actually need champions on the unit level. And I would add, from what we heard from others, it needs to be sustained unit champions on the unit level. It can't be this year it's CAUTI and next year it's something else. Next slide, please. So with those barriers in mind, and then thinking about what some of the things were that these institutions had been implementing, I just put together this slide of what has sounded like to us to be some effective strategies. So feeding back the data seems to be very important, so feeding it back to the front lines. But it's not just feeding back all of the data. In one example we saw, they really followed these three principles. So they kept it simple. They used one measurement that they consistently fed back to the unit, each unit in the hospital. They used days since last CAUTI because it was easy to graph, it was easy for everybody to understand, it was easy to compare one unit to another. But they, every month, that's what they gave them. They didn't give them their rate of CAUTI. They didn't give them their rate of inappropriate use. They just said days since last CAUTI, and everybody in the hospital talked about it. They kept it consistent, so they did it every month. Everybody knew it was coming. It was coming via email. The emails looked the same. That was, I think that was very helpful. And then they also put in a reward system for good performance. So if a unit went a certain number of days without a CAUTI, they received a water bottle, and if they went longer, they received a fruit basket. So you can see what I mean. But people, the wards started talking about this, and they started trying to be those wards that were getting those prizes. And then another principle that we pulled from the interviews that we've done so far is that the enthusiasm and support needs to come both from the top down, like everybody needs to believe that the hospital administration cares about this, but it also needs to come from the bottom up. Those unit level champions who are doing the educating one-on-one seemed very important. And then finally, this idea of the sustained focus, so it's not lost amongst all of the competing priorities that are that we're working on, trying to prevent all of the HAIs and you know, early ambulation and all of the other initiatives. There needs to continue to be some focus on each one moving forward. I don't know how to do that, but that seemed to be important. Next slide. So in summary, I would say that our at this interim stage, our data supports the models that were proposed by Krein and Herod. Physician barriers we found had lessened, but they were still present. The nurse barriers appear to be similar to what they described, and we think that the patient barriers are also lessening. We did identify some new administrative barriers, specifically around reporting issues, and feel that at this point, probably the best recommendation is to make sure that it's a sustained effort with a simple message, which may be the key to actually moving the needle on this issue. That is all I have. Thank you.
Thank you all so much for sharing this information, and especially the interviews and the quotes. I think those are really helpful. We'd now like to open up the call to questions from our audience. Operator, can you begin the Q&A session by giving instructions?
Thank you very much. Ladies and gentlemen, at this time, we would like to open the floor for questions. If you would like to ask a question, please press star 1 on your touch-tone phone now. Questions will be taken in the order in which they are received. If at any time you would like to remove yourself from the questioning queue, please press star 2. Once again, as a reminder, if you would like to ask a question, please press star 1 on your touch-tone phone now.
You guys can also enter questions into the chat, so if we don't get to them on the call, we can send them to our guest speakers and get a response out to you that way. So,
thank you. Our first question will come from Jane Johnston, Shore Memorial.
Hi. Thanks for taking my question. We're very involved with working with our frontline staff, and the problem that we're running into with maintaining Foley's is that we really don't have any great ideas for non-acute retention patients, especially the old guys. I was hoping if anyone had some novel ideas that they're trying.
You know, would you explain it a little bit more? Non-acute retention, you mean someone with a chronic urinary catheter?
Chronic retention, usually...
Is this obstructive or non-obstructive?
It's usually with big prostates.
So with obstructive, it's really tough because, you know...
I know, and that's...
Placing a catheter, you know, you can't do straight cathing, you know, or in and out in these cases. It's usually... the reason why it's there is because it's... inability to drain. You know, in these cases, what we do is we suggest urology to evaluate and whether these chronic catheters need to be chronic or there's either surgical intervention, you know, for the size of the prostate or there's any other alternatives, you know, for that patient other than the catheter.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Once again, as a reminder, if you would like to ask a question, please press star 1 on your touch-tone phone now. Our next question will come from Peggy Thompson, Tampa General Hospital.
Hi, this question is for Dr. Fakih. Dr. Fakih, we've done a lot of work on reducing catheter days, and actually our utilization rates are quite low in our intensive care units. And we've turned our efforts towards reducing unnecessary urine cultures. And one of the things we're in the process of trying to implement is restricting urine cultures to the criteria that you outlined in one of your recent presentations. And one of the questions that's come up recently was, what about patients with sudden onset of delirium, specifically gerontology patients? And I wasn't quite sure how to respond to that question.
That's a great question. You know, so theoretically, if someone develops delirium, it may be related to sepsis, and part of looking up patients for sepsis is looking at the urinary tract. I think, you know, what we do, if you remember the presentation, what we focus on is a good clinical evaluation of the patient. You know, and you know, if the clinical evaluation suggests that this delirium may be related to infectious etiology and there is no other source, so you know, patient doesn't have evidence of worsening respiratory function, you know, you don't see, you know, evidence of pneumonia, there's no intra-abdominal catastrophe, and, you know, the patient has a catheter, part of the evaluation, if you feel clinically that this may be a source, then it is a legitimate thing to do during the urine culture. These will not be, you know, the mainstream cases. What we usually see, and I am, you know, I'm very impressed what you did. First of all, you reduced urinary catheter harm by reducing utilization, and also you're pushing for appropriate urine culturing. One of the things we have seen in many hospitals is these automatic orders for urine cultures, either based on urine analysis, that's a screening urine analysis, and we know a lot of patients with urinary catheter will develop pyuria because of the inflammatory response to the foreign body. And then you get a urine culture based on that positive white cells in the urine. If it's not based on a clinical impression or someone evaluating the patient, I don't think it's fair to our patients. This is what we push for, a better evaluation before ordering these tests. I don't know if I answered your question.
You did. I think one of the things we're struggling with is the pan culturing. You know, we're a teaching hospital, and so we get a fair amount of patient has a fever spike. They've got a Foley catheter in, and then we get the automatic urine culture ordered. So we've tried to put some specific criteria down for ordering the urine culture that will eliminate those, but we don't want to make them so stringent that we can't get cultures in patient populations that we really need them in.
Absolutely. I can give you an example. So we have a surgical intensive care unit which has a lot of neurotrauma. So, you know, you would imagine neurotrauma, you get a lot of fevers related to the CNS. For the longest time, we had a very high SIR, and the last 6 months there has been a great drop in our SIR. And one major thing that was different recently is that the surgical intensivist owned it. So they have their team. It's almost a closed unit. There's still people who can come in and write orders. But, you know, for the last 6-7 months, it's only their unit team that's writing the orders. They know the patient the most. So if there's any change in the condition, they'll know it better than someone, let's say, a rehab doctor or another surgeon who's seen the patient just one time, or an internist, or, you know. So I think we go back to making sure that the ones that know the patient the best evaluate that patient. It makes a huge difference. And accountability. When it's only one group that is dealing with that patient, they know the patient very well, they have a plan, they can understand what the fever is about, and if there's no other source, then it is something important for them to do the urine culture if this is the source they're worried about. So we don't want people to stop doing urine culture, but we're pushing for appropriate utilization of these tests.
Right, right. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you once again. As a reminder, if you would like to ask a question, you may press star 1 on your touch-tone phone now. Well, speakers, at this time, we have no further questions in the queue.
So while we wait for questions, because I'm sure you guys are thinking of some good ones for our presenters, I do want to remind everyone to take a quick moment to complete an evaluation of today's webinar. You'll find the link on the left side of your screen in the chat. Just a quick survey about our presenters and the content, and if there's anything else you would like us to present on upcoming webinars. And then I'll also give you a quick preview of our upcoming webinars for October, November, and December. And you'll see the topics there on the right side. Next month, we have Dr. Lisa Lubomsky, who will be presenting on the FAST fact sheet and science of safety. She'll also have a unit team presenting with her, so be sure to join us then.
Again, as a reminder, to ask a question, you may press star 1 on your touch-tone phone now. Ms. Hoffman, at this time, we have no questions.
All right. Any last thoughts or words from our guest speakers today?
Well, we thank the audience, and I think, honestly, I think it was a great thing that talking about MDROs, C. diff, and also linking it to how to remove that catheter. So it was something I learned from today. It's not just focusing on the MDROs, but seeing how we can, you know, use all these things and put them together to help us reduce the harm of the catheter.
I agree. I learned some things, too, so thank you to the other speakers.
Likewise.
All right. Well, to the audience, again, if you have any questions, feel free to contact us. I'll put the email address in the chat as well, so you can send us questions at any time, and we can send those to our presenters today. But we'd like to thank everyone for your participation in today's call and for the great questions, and we'll give you 4 minutes back of your day.
Thank you, everyone. Thanks, Ashley. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thank you very much. Ladies and gentlemen, at this time, this conference is now concluded. You may disconnect your phone lines and have a great rest of the week. Thank you.